multicolor cultural laser. We travel the world for the boys and the girls, casting pods of wonder and amazement.
S.J. Fowler.
We're here in London at the Rich Mix for a full day of, I can never say the word right, camarada.
Everyone pronounces it in different ways. So it's camaraderie, it's camarada, it's come a chameleon. There's lots of different variations, but it's Camarada Fest. Around 100 poets collaborating in 50 pairs, producing original works, each for 5 minutes over a whole day. Yeah. So the idea is to bring together a variety of different styles of poetics and different communities in one giant, warm, friendly, all day romp through collaborative poetics. I was really fortunate early on in my writing career, almost within 6 months of when I started putting stuff out publicly, to be involved in a couple of projects that were about collaboration, but they weren't within poetry. They were poetry and composition, poetry and art. And I kind of saw the models in which they did those things, and they were very heavy on criticism of the process and understanding the process, probably to justify funding. And it just seemed really apparent to me that within poetry, so much of what's problematic and slows things down and stops communities coming together and stops new work happening is actually the way in which the process of writing poetry is seen. And it's so simple to introduce two people together, to give them a really small remit of time and not give them any criteria for what they should write about, and see them blossom in terms of their practice together and their feeling of an event. I've always said with Camarada, it's about the process. The work will come. If people feel comfortable, if people are happily paired, they will generate things that they wouldn't normally generate. They will go outside of their comfort zones, and it really expands everything they do. And it's such a simple idea, and people are so generous. They give the time for free, and they do it because everyone thinks it's a novel way to expand their work. So yeah, it's been so easy to develop it from my early projects and practice and my own personal poetry collaborations into like another stream, an organizational stream. So I have put these poets together over 5 Camarada events, and this is kind of the apotheosis, the grand day where it's kind of all coming together, and it's been amazing. So yeah, I'm very lucky to be involved in it.
Has anybody really resisted doing it?
I've told this story a few times, like I won't mention anyone's names, but I've put together around 160 pairs, and I am kind of like the Wizard of Oz, and behind the curtains I'm the one choosing the pairs. People often ask, oh, who asks for who? Well, I kind of go with the flow, but generally I'm the one who puts people together, and often they don't know each other. And in all those 160, only 2 pairs have failed. Only 2 have been problematic. And the reason was, while they agreed to it, they obviously just didn't really concentrate on what the notion was, and they were very protective of their work and what their work meant. And everyone else, even people who are known for being about the muse and inspiration, understand that the point of Camarada is that you give. And if that's the spirit, that actually affects everything. It permeates through the whole day, through the work and the process. So yeah, I've had virtually no problems. It's been a bit of a dream putting people together. They're so keen to do it.
Yeah, well, I mean, what I like about it is because I'm so, I wouldn't say I'm precious, but I wouldn't want to read a poem that I've not worked on very hard at an event. But then here, because the time pressure, that like you do it in 2 weeks or a month, and then nobody really knows who wrote which lines, so the stakes for me like seem much lower. My ego disappears in a way, which I think is really nice. It's a much more freeing way to write and to consider performing.
Definitely. And I think when you actually step back from that process, a lot of the time when you're writing poetry, you internalize like a subjective value, but you can't really judge your own work so well. Obviously, there's basic standards where you haven't worked on a poem and you realize it's not ready. But in general, what people find in your work is completely individualized. It's about their life, their experience, their understanding of language. So half the time when people use fragments in their text in avant-garde methods, or use found text or chop things up, they tend to be fantastic. And I think the fact that people can't overwork this poetry doesn't in any way diminish its quality. If anything, if you see today's work and some of the excerpts you'll hear, the quality is really, really high, because what's happening is a completely unique process and methodology. And that fear that a lot of people have, oh, I won't have the time to really edit it and go through, really becomes immaterial. And also there's that sense that you refer to of like spreading the blame socially. People don't feel as responsible, that they can look over to their partner and say, yeah, it was mainly them. But in the end, that never happens. And quite a few of the pairs I put together have gone on to write full collections together and begin long friendships. And there's quite major books coming out of some of this stuff that I've begun because people have an excuse. They don't want to be the first person to email. They don't want to be the first person to say, or that it doesn't occur to them, as you mentioned, oh, I'd like to collaborate with you. I'd like to work with you. You know, and I've been doing that for a few years, as you know, I've done it with yourself. So I think that's a very easy to bring that barrier down, and people are very grateful for me being the kind of middleman in that way.
It's strange. It's strange that poetry doesn't have that, because in every other art form, you know, you have painters working on things together. You have musicians obviously jamming together. It happens all the time. But like within, I guess, words, but I mean, I don't know, maybe you know better than I do, but certainly with poetry and literature, you don't see that kind of riffing. Peter Straub wrote a novel with Stephen King once.
That's definitely an excellent reference as it comes to the Camarada Fest, the Shining Fest. I think that there's two things to say there. One, I do think it's a bit of a misnomer that there hasn't been a lot of collaboration. I think outside of the UK and even within the UK, there has absolutely been the history of poetry is the history of collaboration, especially when it comes to collectives and groupings. And then actually, I'm curating an exhibition with Chris McCabe in 2014 at the Poetry Library about the history of collaboration. And that'll show the evidence of all these exchanges. But you're absolutely correct in the most material sense that it's not associated with poetry practice. And I think that's because of the immensely damaging and wrong-headed myth of the poet being this subjective reception of inspiration, which, you know, obviously everyone knows who knows me that I find that really repulsive, because it posits the idea that certain people have a gift that other people can't possibly get, that it's just inborn or a gift from God, you know. And that theological model of poetics is the problematic with teaching poetry, receiving poetry, people's opinion of poetry, and collaboration gets to really tear that down in a way. And I'm happy to put it out in public record, I try to be really polite and gentle with people, but this methodology is also a way of kind of being a bit of a terrorist and getting inside of people's practices and ripping up the floorboards of their idea that they think their work is so special because they were in the right mood that day. Well, they just get together with another person and they produce something that everyone loves as much as their other work, and they might just realize that actually it's not that special, the process. It's just about generating language from your own experience of the world.
That's a great way to start. Let's tear down some of these boundaries. Let's ruin some myths. Let's be terrorists.
So here's some excerpts from Camarada Fest, everybody. In the background, you're going to hear some music from the band Bark Tree. They've got a new album out called I. It's with alreadydeadtapes.com. It comes on an elegant cassette tape. At the end of the podcast, you're going to hear a full song. It's called Xylophone Lacoustic. And we'll start the podcast with Marcus Slees and Claire Potter.
I am Claire Potter. This is Marcus Slees.
Hello.
For our collaboration, we decided to arbitrarily link our works together through the themes of trains and foreskins. I can deliver on trains, but you're on your own with foreskins, I'm afraid.
On a train to Durham, sitting backwards. The secret is to move to the front of the train to grab a seat. If you follow the perfume in full color spread, mighty head is dead. This poem is for hands. Squeezed in at King's Cross, big people sitting next to me during my period of flipping cushions, this carriage smells of news, like the foreskin pulled back. Why is it so warm? Why do we want to hold it? I was taken on the couch, the dog peed in the corner. I was introduced to fridge magnets and American presidents in 1986.
I have a feeling that Brendan Brady's gonna die this week. I have a horrible, horrible feeling that Brendan's going to die this week, and I'm very, very worried for myself. Last time I saw Brendan was in his flat last week, and his mortal enemy, Walker, arrived in his flat last week at Brendan's old flat last week, where Cheryl, who doesn't even have a Dublin accent, was, but she's got a Northern Irish accent one, and she lives with Scouse Seamus, who doesn't have an Irish accent. He doesn't have an Irish accent at all, if you ask me, and that's where Walker was, and that's why I call him Scouse Seamus. He doesn't have an Irish accent, that's where Walker was. Walker holding a gun to Scouse Seamus's fake Irish bastard head, and Scouse Seamus said his son's name, Brendan.
On a train from Durham, sitting forwards. This carriage smells of news. I was introduced to fridge magnets and American presidents in 1986. I lived in a trailer park in Vallejo and had a gumball machine. It gave me gumballs with a card. All the cards had American presidents. I was becoming an American citizen. I got free lunches. I got free breakfast. I never became an American citizen. E.T. was on the big screen. He had a glowing red finger. E.T. was in a shed. They were eating something called Pizza Hut. I got a fourth-hand BMX bike. I jumped the speed bumps. They wrote my name on the walls. They loved Duran Duran. I was not Duran Duran. My step-grandfather forgot to pick me up. I walked home. I had a funny accent. I lived in many countries. I have many accents. They are layered in my skull. Welcome to my skull. It is your skull, too. On a train to Liverpool, sitting backwards. With Philip Whalen and Eileen Miles and Maureen Owen and Bernadette Mayer, they slow-mo the soap scene in which two hands like someone else's rub and lather every last thing in every form or mode of existence. Today is the last day. Today is the greatest. It's okay. It's all right. It's okay. It's all right. It's all right. It's all right. It's okay. It's all right. It's all right. It's okay. It's all right. It's all right. Flowers fall, squiggly trees. This is my pen. This is my paper. I compose on the road. You can touch it, you can smell it, you can taste it, you can see it. It doesn't exist. The foreskins of weeping strangers. They call it a wishbone, a ghost quiver. I've got to milk it or melt it. Before I was a ghost, I was a ghost.
Scout Seamus has got a horrible face. It's dirty and weird and I'm afraid of that, but it's okay. It's all right, it's okay. It's all right, I'm real and I'll always have that over him. He's just a TV programme. Brendan Brady's sometimes real though. And he's feared, afraid of his dad, of Scout Seamus, because he can't control that clock on the landing. You can't control the sound that's not coming from outside of yourself. He hears feet on the landing. But it's okay. It's all right. It's okay. Brendan's not let me down. It's changed. Everything's changed. Walker's been kicked under. He's been kicked under. He's been booted under a train. Maybe the train to Manchester. It didn't look like a Virgin train, but it was dead fast. Fast enough to smash Walker. Walker's been smashed up, but not there. Not these things. Never these things. It's never over, Stephen. One last parting gift, Walker said. I'll tear that world of yours apart, Walker said. He's gone, Brendan. But these things are never over, Stephen. It's me and you, right, Brendan? We're going to live happily ever after, Brendan. It's just me and you, right? But Brendan's been reading the Bible, and that's a very bad sign.
That's great, guys. That really worked. Were you surprised that it worked out? Okay.
Yeah, actually. It was really interesting how they connected together in surprising ways, especially when we just, you know, decided to use the train kind of connection.
The fortunate thing about when I read this typewriter style writing out is it's so broken, I can just pick up on the it's all right, it's okay, and it just all, it can, like, it can ad lib a little bit with it.
Yeah.
So it's quite fortunate that, yeah, but I was surprised it pulled off the way it did.
Will Rowe.
Stephen Watts. I heard Will read a poem of his about 2 months ago, and it set me thinking about some other poems that I knew or had translated or written. Poetry as vomit, really, as vomiting. Language as vomit.
We've both been translating since we were in nappies, basically, and this is a continuation. How I vomit. Vomit enough. How I do it, and I want to do it. Very much faster than they present themselves. Ungoverned spaces and security vacuum. The horse meat in the English language, if I put it in my mouth.
Elegy by the Romanian poet Mariana Marin.
Translated by Stephen Watts.
If only I could rest in a mountain sanatorium among pink and blue pills. A sanatorium with a strong scent of fir trees and soft carpets. With coquettish, neurotic ladies suffering from nice, small, conjugal conflicts. If only I had a trauma like measles, the pitter of a summer shower, a neurosis like silk after which you are even more loved, a neurosis like the steam of chamomile tea after which you're even more dazed, celestial, and then a tide of your femininity assaults the world, cures it, gives it the thrills of a treasure known only to it. If only I could find rest in all life's scenarios, in the diverse, simple, honest crannies where there's just a bed in which to sleep and a bucket in which to vomit up every last thing that, giving me, you took away, to vomit up incessantly.
Like corralled by colours and obviously attacked by numbers, because you can't move, because your body is made of mirrors. They reflect suffering from any number of distinct places, just such a composition. Wake up to a vacant space, and is there an image somewhere else, my body somewhere in my body, standing up and down? The place wasn't there. The signs don't correspond to the earth. Does the earth? We rub our bodies together and laugh out loud, skin to skin. Is that a place?
Do you remember the man on a summer's night on one of the edges of Milano Stazione Centrale who defecated and then turned to the few onlookers, the passers-by, and said, "Look, this is me, this is what's come out of me, this is what I've given and what I've rejected, you shits."
The city, according to the census, walking through control areas, suicides of disabled people, one after another, emerged from some slight billowing clouds, condensed, white, falling in that vacant place.
I never sang a poem in the Torriano bar but accompanied by a guitar and given good attention. I never cooked mackerel with ginger for a troop of clowns in Kentish town. I never read my poetry at the festival in the ancient town of Starigard on Hvar. I never ran a pub on the western coastline of Norway, sending the stragglers home in the simmer dim. I did not stand on my balcony in London for 35 years, watching all the wee ones grow to their delinquents. I never broke into the homes of my neighbour and stole his laptop, his essays on Macmalbef, his poems on the Sufis and nomads. I did not laugh at the desperation of my father on the 214 bus, mere 3-year-old girl speaking only Mandarin. I was never raped as a 9-year-old child in a children's home, and it is too easy to say that, ever. I did not shout motherfucker after the poet as he walked away from me up the street of dreams. I did not let off bombs in buses or banks, nor did I sleep in the hotels of the rich or porter with the ghosts of the poor. I did none of these things, yet I lived a full life. And then the owl of poetry flew across my face and said to me, "Burn all your poems, shred all your books." And I did, and I was happy, and I went running off alone into the deep zones of the pig herd of all pain. I went flying into the night time to the white owl of all speech, leaving behind me the clamour of my fastidious community, a lozenge of hate in the melt of my reason.
Landscape of the vomiting multitude. Dusk, Coney Island.
Garcia Lorca, translated by Will Rowe.
The fat woman in front came, tearing up roots and spattering the drumskins. The fat woman, who turns the death agony of capitalist octopuses inside out. The fat woman, enemy of the moon, ran through the streets and abandoned apartments and left tiny little pigeon skulls in corners and raised the furies of banquets in final centuries and called the devil which is bred through hills of swept sky and filtered anxiety of light through underground circuits. It's the cemeteries, I know it. It's the cemeteries and the pain of cooking stoves buried beneath the sand. It's the dead, the pheasants and the apples of another time that push up the spew in our throats. Murmurings came from the forest of vomit with vacuumed women, children made of hot wax, fermented trees and tireless waiters serving up plates of salt under harps of saliva. Nothing to be done, my child. Vomit. Nothing to be done. It's not the vomit of hussars on the breasts of a prostitute, not the vomit of the cat who swallowed a frog by mistake. It's the dead scratching with their earthy hands at the flint portals where black clouds and deserts putrefy.
I really like how you mix your own translated work with your own writing. And I was wondering, was that quite freeing to have that much of a palette to draw from when you were dealing writing the poem, or was it a bit more, was it stressful because you have these whole poems of other people's texts?
No, it was freeing. It's freeing. I mean, transition is so wonderful. And for me, transition and writing, although you have to, when you're translating, you're careful of the original text or careful for the original text. But no, they're both the similar activities and they free each other. It's wonderful.
Well, actually, to enter language at all is a translation, but it's not because you enter natural language. It's not because you enter the English language, and I think George Steiner is wrong about it. That's not translation. Translation is entering language with the absolute sense that language has, which is poetry that speaks to and of that absolute language.
Sarah Hesketh.
Julia Bird.
Julia and I both work in events, and so we thought we'd give people a little bit of an insight into how the world of events works.
Sarah, have you got your name badge on?
I have. Julia, have you got your name badge on?
I have.
Blurb. You are invited. For what promises to be, you are invited. For an evening of, for a lively discussion, you are invited. We are delighted to welcome, in partnership with, and specially commissioned, how can we answer this question? Featuring and considering, with a reading from, in conversation with, don't miss out on this very rare. You are invited. You are highly acclaimed. With a Q&A to follow. Ticket price includes refreshment. How many in?
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. And the ushers, 10, 11. And those two we saw in the box office on the way in, if we prop the door open, they surely experience the poetry as profoundly as any paying punter. The gentleman in the back row, his mother always regretted that she didn't have twins. The lady by the aisle, even now she blamed some of her more unfortunate life choices on the malign influence of her childhood invisible friend. The couple in the corner will transcribe almost completely accurately a line of one of tonight's poems in their round-robin Christmas letter, which they will send to 28 people in their address book, 5 of whom live overseas. The lady in the middle dreamt last night of the time she ran from one end of her entire assembled secondary school to the other, to appear in both sides of its annual panoramic photo, and it was a very vivid dream. The lady down the front is totally unaware that her guide dog is expecting 9 guide puppies. The average gentleman's sperm count is between 200 and 400 million per milliliter, and there's nothing to suggest that the gentleman in seat 4B is anything but the average gentleman.
How many in?
Full house! Enjoy the show.
www.artscouncil.org.uk/what-we-do/research-and-data/arts-audiences/arts-based-segmentation-research/the-13-segments. 1. Urban Arts Eclectic. 2. Traditional Culture Vultures. 3. Fun Fashion and Friends. 4. Mature Explorers. 5. Dinner and a Show. 6. Family and Community Focused. 7. Bedroom DJs. 8. Midlife Hobbyists. 9. Retired Arts and Crafts. 10. Time Poor Dreamers. 11. A Quiet Pint with the Match. 12. Older and Homebound. 13. Limited Means. Nothing Fancy.
That's the end of our show. If we could ask you to fill out your exit questionnaires on your way out, we'd be ever so grateful. Thank you.
How did you guys decide to do event stuff?
We went to the pub, didn't we, and decided that we wanted to write about the other side of what it means to be a poet, because there's always someone in the background making sure that people turn up, making sure that everybody's eaten, making sure that everybody can be heard, and we wanted to play with that in a sort of slightly satirical fashion.
The events manager is normally the most invisible person at any kind of event, and I don't think often the audience understands quite how high the level of angst can be for that person at any single event.
Ghazal Mosaddegh.
I'm from Iran.
Ricard Marx, and I'm from Portugal, Lisbon. When I met Ghazal a fortnight ago to discuss what we're going to do in this performance, I realized that the only word I knew in Persian was the word that entitled my country. It's
Portugal.
Portugal means in Persian oranges. So we just decided to do something on that frame of mind and decide to just make poems, throw each other some sentences it would be verses of a poem, that through the sound would work with a different meaning, obviously, because the sounds would be different in the other language. So we just came up with a lot of sentences that would be similar in sound, but obviously would be different in meaning. For example, there's a word azulejo in Portuguese, which means tile.
And then an azulejo in Persian might mean from the envy.
Everything we hear from each other, we just got to, okay, this reminds me of this word in Portuguese, so we'd write a verse. And that's how we came up with two different poems that we translated in the end.
That's like when I read a French newspaper, that's exactly what I do. It makes no sense.
And then I think you kept a sense of sense, kind of, in all your poem, whereas I just went for word-by-word translation.
For me, that's important. I'm not very much a surrealistic poet, so I try to maintain a certain arrangement within the surreal moment of just following the sound of what she was saying.
تشنه سربازی در کتابخانه.
ترتوت فزر و شای کرار و پیان.
دوستی دارم که دیر راه افتاده بود.
خپیده منت مودا و شوری پدی اون بکد.
کسی نشسته آن بالا؟
کمه فی تو اس بول.
در سر افتاد فکری که داشتیمش.
دفسر فی تو تفرینی لگریمش.
این کدام خشت سختیست؟
ای کنتا خشت خسیتا.
خشت حساس محتاط سختیست.
تو خشت خسیتا تا شای دو خیز و کشتنگش.
سربازی دیر کرده بود سربازی دیر کرده بود در کتابخانه کیکی پختند
زپرسیره امیار ارم زپرسیره ارم پسیفل ده آلم
او دیر کرده در آن سوی تب
او گران سکامی بب
جایی که میتوان خورد و نوشید
او جوالی تا این پاسی رونجید
او میدید ما را میدانست چه مان شده
اشتی او گر آنده میمه ایمشمه
All right, so let's hear the Persian version in English first, I guess.
A pawn story. A pawn in a library, thirsty. A friend running late. Is someone sitting upstairs? Doubt crossed my mind, same doubt. What kind of hard brick is this? What kind of careful and sensitive hard brick? A cake baked in the library and the pawn was late. And the pawn was late, he was late, stuck on the other side of fever, where one can eat and drink, where he could see us and know where we are ill.
Thank you.
A pawn story. He started to make tea and to cure the pawn. Quickly he cured the cries and asked for a sip. What is this cake made with? It must be made of flour and tears. And how about the rest of the recipe? With laughter filled and with chestnuts. To disappear is the best weapon. To disappear is the weapon possible to the soul. The place where you can eat and drink. And the knee can also be cured. That is the place where my mother calls.
That's really great, guys. But the title is both the same, right? Like that. How did you manage that?
We just, in this case, we just came up with the title in the end. So since both of them were about actually the pawn, and it's the same thing in Persian and Portuguese, isn't it?
Yeah.
So I say piau, and she says.
Yeah, piau de sarbos.
So it's kind of a similar. So I said, oh, this is the story of a pawn, then. So that's how we did it.
Thank you.
interesting parts of wonder and amazement. Multicolored, cultural.